you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth2letteryou.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, my friend.
Hey, Jono. I mean, what's going on? You're not on Bribey Island anymore.
I'm not on Bribey Island anymore. I'm back on the farm. Really happy about it, actually. Missed it. Back in my studio, Ira. I'm back in the studio. I feel very professional once again.
I was going to sing a Broadway tune, but I know how much you hate those.
Don't do the Broadway thing to me. Moving right along. So, listen, we're not far from the end, you know.
Well, I mean, we're not that far, but what's really exciting is we're getting ready to hear from God soon.
That's right, and it's not too far away. In fact, I do believe we're going to get through chapter 37 today. After that, 38 and 39, we hear from God, so I'm looking forward to that. We'll get to it soon enough, but we actually left off last time we spoke in chapter 36, and we're going to pick up from verse 24, and the reason for that, Ira, is because the topic kind of shifts. This is still Elihu, obviously, but here from 24 on and all through 37, Elihu proclaims God's majesty, and it's mostly straightforward, I think, for the most part. And it begins like this: "Remember to magnify his work, of which men have sung. Everyone has seen it. Man looks on it from afar. Behold, God is great, and we do not know him." Now, that's what I've got in my New King James, and I think I had a look at that. I thought, we do not know him, and lo and behold, him is in italics. Where he says, "Behold, we do not know," is he referring to God, or is he referring to God's greatness? Like, we don't know the extent of God's greatness.
Sure. You know, what I have is, "Behold, God is exalted, and we know him not. The number of his years is unsearchable." When we look at these first couple of verses, you know, what we basically see here is that each man, according to his own perceptions, is able to understand the righteousness and rightness of all of God's works.
Mm-hmm.
However, we are unable to approach God. So it's only through the wisdom that he has given us that we perceive mm-hmm. these things. And it's important that it says that men have sung, because this end of 36 and part of 37 is actually considered a song.
Mm.
And some people call it the Song of Rain, and not R-E-I-G-N, but Rain, R-A-I-N. And we'll see why it refers to that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it goes on to say, "For he draws," this is great, I love this part, "For he draws up drops of water, which distill as rain from the mist, which the clouds drop down and pour abundantly on man." I remember learning this in science. "Indeed, anyone, can anyone understand the spreading of the clouds, the thunder from his canopy? Look, he scatters light upon it and covers the depths of the sea, for by these he judges the peoples. He gives food in abundance, he covers his hands with lightning and commands it to strike, his thunders declare it, the cattle also, concerning the rising storm." That's beautiful.
It is beautiful. And I think when we look at this, obviously you understand now why it's called the Song of Rain.
Mm.
It's in verse 27, you see that spoken of. What's being said here, by Elihu is that if we cannot understand the simple workings of the rain, how in the world would we ever understand the spreading out of the heavens and his habitation?
Mm.
Okay.
Mm.
I also remember this in science. It's so amazing when you learn about lightning and you learn about the positive and the negative charges that mm-hmm. meet, you know, from the ground as opposed to the clouds and so forth, that causes this lightning to take place. And, you know, when we think about the lightning, who really has not marveled at the way the lightning can light up the darkness of the sky? And when we consider the clouds being spread out, when you look at clouds over the sea towards the horizon, it appears as if the clouds are covering the water where they meet.
Mm.
It really is quite amazing when you consider God's, you know, God's creation in that way. I mean, I remember I used to own a condominium on the ocean down in the Florida Keys. And the thing that I enjoyed doing the most at night sometimes during the summer, especially in Florida, we get, you know, a lot of thunderstorms this time of year, late in the day and sometimes late in the evening, was to sit on my balcony with a glass of wine and just see the lightning and thunderstorm over the ocean.
I love that. We do that here in the summer storms. I wait for the summer storms, and when they come, it's just because being in the country here, we can see, you know, clearly in all directions, and you can see it coming, and I love watching it roll in, and the thunder and the wind and the heavy rain and the lightning and everything. It's just spectacular. I love it.
Yeah. The other thing that's amazing in the Hebrew, you know, and this was very interesting to me as a young child, you know, growing up, you know, in an Orthodox synagogue, you know, and learning Hebrew, was the fact that the word for thunder and the word for voice are the same word in Hebrew. It's kol and kol. So if you're going to translate it, it'd be like K-O-L. And so as a child, you know, everybody has different ideas about what thunder is like, but knowing that, when I first learned that, that the word for voice and the word for thunder was the same thing in Hebrew, I always thought that when I heard thunder, I was hearing the voice of God. Now, I know other people say that they thought that the angels were bowling.
Yeah. That's when you hear in the church. Another one I used to hear in the church was, God's moving the furniture.
Oh, God's moving the furniture.
well, actually, we were just talking about the wondrous marvel that is the thunderstorm. But one of the things that always really, I could never really get a grasp of in science. Look, I wasn't the best student, I'll admit. But I remember studying, you know, precipitation. I remember studying the lightning, as you were just saying. One thing I could never really understand, Ira, was how does God, yet he does, how does he maintain thousands of tons of water in the sky and move it around like that?
Right.
I mean, picking up a 10-liter bucket of water is, you know, difficult. You know, I do it often, just walking around with water, trying to fill up the water for the ducks and the chickens and all the other pets and animals and whatnot. And yet God can lift hundreds and thousands of tons of water and just, you know, just sort of move them around, drift them through the sky like that. It's just spectacular. I don't know if I'll ever understand it. Maybe if someone has an answer to that, they can leave it in the comment section.
You would make a great Elihu for that, because this is the kind of, you know, this is the kind of argument that he's bringing now.
I suppose so, yeah. It's exactly what he's doing.
And in many ways, when we look back on a discussion that we had a few chapters back as to whether or not the mediator that was being discussed was Elihu.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, you know, Job was looking for a mediator, and this very much speaks now as if Elihu is no longer acting, well, he is acting as a mediator in that way, but he's now acting on behalf of God, in a sense, that he's speaking for God, because it very much prepares the way. And I think in a lot of ways that what we're going to see as we move forward is that in chapter 36 and 37, that Elihu is now preparing Job to meet God personally and to hear from him personally.
All right, so chapter 37, at this my heart also trembles and leaps from its place. Hear attentively the thunder of his voice. Now, hear attentively is in the plural, right? He's not just talking to Job. He's addressing at least Job's friends, or at least a crowd that's gathered. And the rumbling that comes from his mouth, he sends it forth under the whole heaven, his lightning to the ends of the earth. After it, a voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice and does not restrain them when his voice is heard. God thunders marvelously with his voice. He does great things which we cannot comprehend. For he says to the snow, fall on the earth, likewise to the gentle rain and the heavy rain of his strength. He seals the hand of every man, that all men may know his work.
You know, I mean, this is just, I could listen, you know, first of all, I love hearing it with your accent, so I could listen to you.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's such, it really, when you're speaking about the magnificence of God and God's creation, I mean, why would you not want to listen to that being recounted over and over and over
again?
Yeah. You know, when we start in the beginning of chapter 37, we're seeing that this is referring to the previous verses where God is seen as one who takes lightning as a warrior and casts it down like a spear upon its mark.
Now, isn't that the imagery that we get when we think of Greek gods like Zeus, for example? I think.
Absolutely, but this is really what it was speaking about when we talked about in verse 36, the idea that he casts lightning and it strikes its mark.
Mm.
The imagery that really is the imagery of God being seen as a warrior casting down lightning like a spear.
Yeah,
it hits its mark wherever he decides to cast it, and it really, you know, remember a lot of. You know, we see both sides going back and forth. I mean, there's a lot of borrowing of imagery in pagan cultures, and certainly, you know, in one of the main pagan religions today, you know, that borrows heavily from other pagan cultures as it relates to imagery, you know, related to divinity and deity. And leave it there without getting myself into real trouble.
Well, I'll tell you what we can do. Let's just stick within the Tanakh, because the Canaanite deity Baal is often attributed with these powers. With, I do believe we have a number of figurines of him, ancient figurines, with a lightning bolt in hand. Am I right about that?
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, because he was understood to be the god of the storm, the god of the thunderstorm.
Right.
Brings the rain.
Yeah, it's never unusual to see that type of imagery used for pagan gods, because they're always going to try and imitate the one true God.
Amen. So it goes on to say, the beasts go into their dens and remain in their lairs from the chambers. Now, I've got a few italics here, Ira. This is verse 9. From the chambers of the south, in italics, comes whirlwind and cold from the scattering winds, in italics, of the north.
Right. And the reason you have that is because of the words that are used here. Really what it is these are words that that can mean different things. What I have for verse 9 actually is, from its chambers comes the whirlwind and cold from the scattering winds or the north winds. But one of the things that we're talking about when we see this idea of, you know, because it says, min hacheder Tavo sufa umim zarim, umim zarim kara. Umim zarim, this mizarim, actually can mean constellations. And if you look at chapter 38, if you go forward in chapter 38, I think you have your Bible open, verses 31 and 32, if you read that.
Says, can you bind the cluster of Pleiades, right, or loosen the belts of Orion?
Right. And then what else?
You bring out Maserot in its season, or can you guide the great bear with its cubs?
Right. And so what this is talking about is the same. It's the same in the Hebrew that we see when it says, can you lead out constellations either in their times or seasons and lead the bear with her sons, in verse 32, and can you bind the bonds Pleiades or undo the cords of Orion? These are all constellations. Ursa, yeah. Major, and Minor are considered the bears, and Pleiades is seven sisters, is called seven sisters, and is a star cluster close to Earth and most visible by the naked eye.
Right.
So it could be talking about the constellations as well. And this is talking, again, remember, we're talking about this imagery of rain and thunder and lightning and God, you know, spreading out the heavens, the clouds, and so forth. You know, it's speaking about the constellations as well, that he's in control of all these things and keeps all of these things, you know, when we're talking about snow and rain and thunder and lightning, all of these, you know, within their place.
So I'm going to return to the concept of the north when we get to verse 22. But verse 10, by the breath of God, ice is given, and the broad waters are frozen, and the moisture, he saturates the thick clouds. He scatters his bright clouds, and they swirl around, being turned by his guidance, that they may do whatever he commands them on the face of the whole land, on the face of the whole earth. He causes it to come, whether for correction, or for his land, or for mercy.
I love verse 12. And the way I translate it is, they turn around and around by his counsel to accomplish all that he commands them on the face of the habitable world.
That's beautiful. That's good.
So it's talking about, what it's talking about is the movement of the clouds, just like the constellations in the sky are not by happenstance. That everything is as a result of the movement of God's hand. When we look at the clouds, I mean, who doesn't sometimes, you know, I don't know what it's like in Australia, but we just had a close friend of ours, close friend of the family, retired and moved down to Florida. She's from New York originally, there her whole life. And she is so mesmerized by the cloud, the way the clouds look in Florida. Because the clouds sometimes look like you can almost reach out and touch them, and they're layers. It's not like so high up in the heavens or in the skies, like in other parts of the, you know, the states here, you know, the far north you go, it doesn't look like that. And you can easily sometimes look up and just see the clouds moving across the sky. And this is what verse 12 is really speaking about. And, and then think about it in verse 13, that all of these things that God controls, he controls for whatever he desires, whether it's for correction or for his land, meaning to bring forth crops and to bring forth, you know, greenery and so forth, or for mercy. He makes it come forth. And on the root translations is actually rod. So when it says correction, it's talking about rod. So this is believed to be related to a punishing rod, thus the translation of correction. So.
Right. And it goes on to say in 14, listen to this, O Job, and stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. Do you know when God dispatches them? And can you cause the light of his cloud to shine? Do you know how the clouds are balanced? That's what I was talking about. I've got no idea. Those wondrous works of him who is in perfect knowledge. There's he who is in perfect knowledge. Remember we spoke about that in verse 36, where it seemed in, in verse 4, where it seemed like Elihu was proclaiming himself as one who is perfect in knowledge is with you. But judging by this verse, 37 verse 16, it certainly appears that he was talking about God. He says that the wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge. Now, it gets kind of weird from 17 onwards. He says a lot of strange stuff. Maybe your translation is a little clearer, but this is what it says in the New King James, Ira. It says, why are your garments hot when he quiets the earth by the south wind? What have you got in 17?
You know, if I wanted to do like a real literal translation,
go on.
It would be, which your garments are hot when the earth is still because of the south wind.
Okay, and so that's, so you're hot. Okay, oh, I can deal with that. 18, with him, have you spread out the skies strong as a cast metal mirror? What? Come on, help me out, Ira. What's that about?
Well, I mean, you know, we're talking about poetic language here. And so, you know, when he's talking about, like, the idea of the south wind and so forth, again, he's talking about things related to God, the things that God does. So when he's talking about, can you, like him, sprout out the sky strong as a cast metal mirror, I mean, think about it. Think about what he's talking about. And I think we need to go forward in this, because it goes on to say in verse 9, it teach us or inform us what we shall say to him. We cannot draw up our case because of darkness. This comes, and I'm speaking about it because this comes from the root to lay out or to arrange. And this word, because it says, Hodienu ma nomar lo na'aruch mipnei choshech. Okay, and it's talking about this idea that word na'aruch actually can be related to a battle plan. To one who lays out or arranges a battle plan. So this idea of a cast metal mirror can also be related to kind of a shield, so forth.
I'm just trying to remember, Ira, because I do recall somewhere that, and I'm just trying to remember, somewhere it talks about the skies being held up like iron, as if to say it's hard, it's clear, it's not going to, there's no rain in them. Do you know where that reference might be? I'm trying to figure it out. Oh, okay. I'll also make your sky like iron and your earth like bronze. That's the one. So that's Leviticus 26 verse 19. In fact, you know what? It's reiterated in Deuteronomy 28 verse 23. The sky above you will become bronze and the earth beneath you iron.
Interesting.
Very interesting.
I remember that verse.
Yeah. Leviticus 26 verse 19 and Deuteronomy 28 verse 23. I tell you what, Ira, if I had a cross-reference Bible, I'd be putting those ones on this verse here, which is Job 37 verse 18. But moving along, teach us what we should say to him, for we can prepare nothing because of the darkness. Again, what's that?
Right, so what I was saying is that word na'aruch, you know, is related to a root meaning to lay out or to arrange, as in a battle plan or to confront. And I think what he's saying here is that you, Job, have had this dream that if only you could confront God face to face, that you would be able to lay out your case. You would be able to arrange it. Do you now see how puny you are in the face of his omnipotence, you know, with what I've laid out? and what I'm speaking about, and God's magnificence.
So where it says we can prepare nothing because of the darkness, that's not...
Right. It's suggesting the darkness that, just like we said, everything that is controlled is controlled by God, so that he can spread out the skies and he can make the sky look like cast metal. He can look at make
Oh, I'm with you. Okay. All right. Fair enough. Okay.
All these things. And at the same time, you know, what are you going to do because of darkness? You have no idea what's going on. You think you're speaking in light. It can mean both of those things. It can speak about his lack of wisdom as well.
Should he be told that I wish to speak? If a man were to speak, surely he would be swallowed up. Even now, men cannot look at the lights when it is bright in the skies, when the wind has passed and cleared them. So he's saying, you know, obviously you can't stare up into the sun. It's way too bright. On a sunny day, you've got to shade your eyes. How much more the majesty of God? Fair enough.
Yeah, and there's another possible interpretation of this as well, of these two verses.
Go on.
Verse 20, there's two other translations. One is that he must be informed of what I speak, must everything man say be revealed. And another way it could be translated is, must he be informed of what I speak? Is then anything man says hidden from him or covered?
Ah, okay.
Right. But now 21 is interesting because when it says, and now no one looks on the light when it is bright in the skies, when the wind has passed and cleared them. Mm. When the wind has passed and cleared what? When the wind has passed and cleared the clouds.
The clouds, yeah, obviously, yeah.
That's where it brings light. That's where we see the sun comes out and its brightness, and certainly you can't look up to that. But this could also be a reference to the friends as well, who are not able to really discern wisdom even when it's made clear. Like, in other words, remember, the friends weren't really bringing wisdom. They thought that they were bringing a proper rebuke, but they weren't. So that might be a more underlying interpretation that we could see as kind of a subtle hit upon the friends.
Fair enough. So verse 22, here, this is, I don't know that this is controversial, I don't know, but it's curious. He comes from the north, Ira. I feel a little bit cheated.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm much further away from God then, doesn't that mean? I mean, there you are all the way up there, but I'm down here on the bottom of the earth.
That's not what it says.
He comes from the north, that's what it says.
It does not say that.
It says that in my Bible. I'm looking at it, he comes from the north.
What's your Bible says?
He's, you know, I know, and not only that, but Superman comes from the north. Santa Claus comes from the north.
All right. Sir,
I'm all the way down here. You cheated.
First of all, what it says is, Mitzafon zahav ye'ete al Eloha nora hod. Okay. Out of the north comes gold.
What? I don't have that. It says he comes from the... What?
It's because you're reading...
No, wait a minute. I've got a cross-reference on 22. It says he comes from the north, and you go to the cross-reference, and it takes me over to Isaiah chapter, or Isaiah, as you say, chapter 14, verse 13. And this is, Ira, this is the fall of Satan with a capital S, except we don't call him Satan here, we call him Lucifer. It's kind of like...
I had this discussion earlier today.
Really?
Yeah, I had a Lucifer discussion earlier today.
It says...
The bright morning star. Do we want to go to Revelation and talk about that too?
It says... For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north.
All right, so what's your point?
Well, I'm not making the point, I'm just saying there's a cross-reference here, and it says in the little study notes of 22 in my New King James Nelson Study Bible, the north, in ancient times, Ira, north was viewed... as the direction of God's abiding place, see Isaiah 14:13.
Mm-hmm.
There's the proof.
It is?
Well, because in verse 12 it says, oh, you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer. Oh, look, wait, there's an asterisk. There's an asterisk there. Yeah, O Lucifer, capital L, Isaiah 14, verse 12.
Oh,
you stop interrupting me. You have fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. Now, it does say... And I have to say, Ira, I love the New King James Study Bible, and the listeners know that I do, because it tells you when they're lying to you. And but they put it in the smallest possible print that they can get hold of, and down in the little notes in the little tiny print next to the asterisk, it says literally. In other words, what we wrote isn't literally what it says, but literally day star. But they decided to make it into a name and give it a capital L.
Well, of course they did.
Of course they did. And then of course, we have a whole lot of... Now, we've dealt with the... And the listeners know that we've dealt with the Satan capital S thing before. And if you missed that, then you'll find it in the first chapters of Job, where we talk about it there. Here, we're to understand through theological hoops, jumping of theological hoops in the Christian church, that this Lucifer character that they've conjured up is also Satan. In any case, it goes on to say, Son of the Morning, how you were cut down to the ground, you weakened the nations, for you have said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, I will sit on the mount of congregation, on the farthest sides of the north, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, I will be like the Most High, yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. And really, if I remember correctly, I think it's talking about the king of Babylon. Oh, look at this, Ira, in verse 11, your pomp is brought down to Sheol, and the sound of your stringed instruments, the maggots, is spread under you, and worms cover you. Like a bit of that.
Right. Do you know who it's talking about?
What is it talking about?
You know who it's talking about.
Who's it talking about? Is it talking about Nebuchadnezzar?
It's talking about an earthly king. And
the king of Babylon, right?
It says, how you are fallen from heaven. The Hebrew, you know what it says, Ech nafalta mishamayim helel. Okay, helel actually means shining one.
Mm-hmm. So it's talking poetically about the king of Babylon.
Shining one, ben shachar. So it's called helel ben shachar. And shachar means dawn. It means light. We say shachar, like shacharit, which is the morning blessings that we say in Judaism, comes from shachar, which is the first light we see, son of the dawn.
Mm-hmm.
So it's shining one, son of the dawn. So there's no such thing as Lucifer in there. And this is talking about the king, the earthly king, who you mentioned already.
Mm-hmm.
And when we go back to 37:22, when it says Mitzafon Zahav means gold, and the mem there, mi, is the preposition from. So it's saying Mitzafon, from the north, gold. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mitzafon Zahav Ye'eteh. Ye'eteh is from one of the verbs for to bring or to come. So Mitzafon Zahav Ye'eteh, you know, is talking about from the north brings gold, or from the north comes gold. Al Eloha Norahod. God is clothed with awesome splendor. But what is this talking about? It's talking about what we just said. When the wind clears the clouds and brings light, what comes through? The golden rays of the sun emerge.
Mm.
Is that Mitzafon Zahav Ye'eteh? It brings forth gold, the north. This is similar to the verse above, as I said, which speaks of the north winds clearing out the sky. It would seem, like I said, we already mentioned, that in these last verses, Elihu is actually preparing Job to meet, but not only to meet, to hear from God out of the whirlwind,
mm-hmm.
out of whirlwind. In other words, this is not just simply the light of the sun, but ushers in the majesty of God. That as these things clear out, he's getting ready to be confronted with the majesty of God that comes forth as gold and sunlight, golden rays from the north. So this might be one of the reasons why we see those kind of ancient traditions of the, you know, the canopy of God, or the booth, or the tabernacle of God being in the north. But, we're not talking about Santa Claus here.
We're not talking about Santa Claus. We're not talking about the solitude of the fortress of solitude, which is Superman's house. But does that appear, by the way, did you go and see The Man of Steel? Does anyone see that?
I have not seen it, but, you know, Yoel didn't like it too much, so.
Really? He wasn't into it? He's a bit of a comic buff, Yoel, so he would know.
Yeah, well, he posted something the other day about, you know, he didn't get it. But everybody else I've heard has liked it, so.
Has liked it? Maybe he's a little bit more critical because he knows his comic books, but. So I don't have to feel left out, is what you're saying. But no. By the way, I still do, because you guys have the Northern Lights. I mean, up in the north there, I mean, in at least Alaska and around there, you guys get some really cool stuff going on in the sky. I don't think we have that down here in the south.
You couldn't get any further from where I live. You couldn't get any further away from Alaska. So, I mean, remember, I live in Florida.
Yeah.
Way on the southeast end. So I'm about as south as you can get, like you are south. So without being in South America.
Right. So, as for the Almighty, we cannot find him, is what I've got. He is excellent in power, in judgment, and abundant in justice. He does not oppress. We cannot find him? Is that to say if we were to search the earth, he's not here with us. He's beyond us. He's above us. He's greater than us.
Yeah, that's true. It is that, you know, it's not, you know, we can't find him in the sense that that's the point that's being made, that, you know, what I was bringing up before, that when we talk about God's habitation, there isn't a specific place that we can put that this is God's temple, this is God's house. You know, when we see this poetic imagery of God having a throne and the throne room of God and so forth, I imagine that there is some place like that, but it's not something that we're going to be able to find, and certainly not something that we're going to be able to point to and say, this is where God is, this is where God is, you know, I know where the Almighty is, I can go find him. I like the way my translation is, that the Almighty, we cannot find him, is exalted in power, mm-hmm. justice and abundant righteousness he will not violate or oppress. The reason why I bring that in that way, and it is, you know, a good translation from the Hebrew, because it seems that based on this perspective that Elihu is preparing Job in such a way that if God actually does show up, you know, because we don't know at this point, you know, we know because we know, you know, that the scripture is set out for us in chapters and we know what's coming next, but, you know, they certainly didn't know this. So he's kind of saying that if God does actually show up, that you really have nothing to fear, Job, because it's not with the intention to overwhelm you or destroy you, to violate you or oppress you.
Mm-hmm. And that's what makes him different from Job's other three friends, really.
Absolutely.
Okay, and so it ends. This is chapter 37, the last verse, verse 24. Therefore, men fear him. Therefore, men fear God. He shows no partiality to any who are wise of heart.
So that's interesting. It really is a very interesting verse. And 37 is really, you know, there are some strange verses in there.
Mm.
It could be one of those chapters that's really hard to understand. Sometimes some of it makes so much sense when you're speaking about the wonders of God.
Mm.
You know, my the way I have it translated here is, therefore men fear him. He does not regard. It could be not see or not look upon any who are wise in their own heart. I think in this single verse, Elihu describes the error of Job in light of all that he has said related to the majesty of God. Because of, as we've looked at already, this is what we see. By wanting to face God before the bar of justice, by wanting to accuse God of being unfair to him, by wanting to accuse God of being his enemy, and by believing that God is taking pleasure in his suffering, in this, even inadvertently, Job has attempted to cut down God to human size. And we talked about this before.
Mm.
But now in this final verse, as quickly as he appeared out of the shadows, Elihu disappears.
He does, doesn't he? He's absolute. That's the last words from Elihu. And and as you say, the significant last words, God does not show partiality, Job, so get over that. And then he's gone, no more Elihu.
And then we hear out of the whirlwind, and certainly a lot of what Elihu brings forth is supported by the way in which God answers Job.
Hmm. So true, and we're going to get to that next week. That's going to be chapter 38. We're going to have to do 38 and 39, I think, Ira. There's a lot in it, but God speaks, and it continues on in both of those chapters. And it begins with, then Yehovah answered Job out of the whirlwind and said. We're going to find out what he said next week. But in the meantime, thank you, my friend, for coming back onto Treasures from the Tanakh. And just a reminder to the listeners, Ira's website is TorahThreads.com. Bright, shiny, beautiful website that it is. If you haven't been there, you should go there, because there's a plethora of information, as well as that which is available on Facebook, Torah Threads and Treasures from the Tanakh on Facebook, those pages. Go there and have a bit of a fish around. Thank you once again, my friend, and until next week, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's Word. Shalom.